Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Welcome, welcome. And I'm so pleased today to be talking with Jackie Holder, artist, creative, author, coach, writer, a whole multitude of things that you do, Jackie. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, I'm really delighted to be here, Robert, and thank you for inviting me to share this space with you. I'm really looking forward to it. And I have to say, I noticed a little tinge when you said artist. I was like, oh no, don't call me an artist. Then it was creative, then it was coach, then it was supervisor. And, you know, I think that may be a really interesting place to for us to start our conversation today because, you know, even though I have done all of those things, I think sometimes when we name all of those things, yes, it's really important for us to acknowledge and appreciate our achievements, our successes. But I notice myself as a Black woman in the industry kind of thinking, oh, no. You know, is that me showing off? Is that me trying to, you know, I've done all these things. I've got all these titles after my name because what it does in me is it brings up this whole tyranny of expectation. I got that term from my friend Jenny when we used to run a coach training program together. It comes from a book called Women's Ways of Knowing. And I can really identify with that term, the tyranny of expectation, in terms of the expectations that I know I have placed on myself as a Black woman born in the UK, brought up in the UK, working professionally in the UK as a coach and a facilitator. And just all the different cultural nuances I had growing up, you know, my parents came from Barbados in the Caribbean. They came here in the early 1960s. They accomplished a huge amount with very little, you know, owning their first home by 1967 in a suburb in South London, raising six children. And my dad's mantra was, you've got to work hard. You know, to get anywhere in life, it's about hard work. So talk about growing up with a Protestant work ethic. You know what I mean? That was it for me. So that whole mantra around working hard and then, you know, naming your successes, sometimes we can be a bit bashful.
It's really interesting you talk about being bashful or sort of feeling that energy as those things are labeled. And it's really, as I think about, you know, working as a coach, we often, I guess, shy away from labeling people because it kind of minimalizes them. It kind of says that you are just this thing as opposed to all of the other things that you are as a human being. And I remember talking with Nick and a few of our trainers about language and how important it is to be really clear about the language that we use. So when you think about describing yourself, what words might come to mind for you?
Well, I was struck there by you using the word human being, because I think that's like where I want to start, because I think those titles and the qualifications often take us into what we have done, what we have accumulated, rather than who I am being when I am with another human being in a room, in the context of coaching, or in the context of, you know, you and I here on this conversation and being very present. With you, being present with myself, being in this moment, you know, Susan Scott says, be here right now, be prepared to be nowhere else. For me, that is core and essential to how I feel I show up as a coach. I see it that for me, it is about recognizing that I see people and I really see people. And that we are all here to be seen based on that African saying that has got sort of, you know, so many people have kind of taken it into their trainings without really appreciating what that really stands for from, you know, that word Sowabona. I hope I'm, you know, pronouncing it correctly, but it's, you know, when people in Africa saw each other. And I know for me, coming from, my parents come from the Caribbean, this is what we do when we're in the Caribbean. When you see elders on the streets, when you see people, you say good morning. You make sure that you see somebody. You see beyond the person who is in the clothes, in the room, in the role, you know. And so for me, that is fundamental to how I am as a coach. You know, I get titles like leadership coach, which means you do a bit of, you know, executive coaching, as if we're going into organizations and working with some other human being, you know, other than, you know, the normal person who's walking along the street. But of course we are, you know. No, go on, Robert.
Yeah, and that always strikes me as interesting, because often when you work with executives, people will say, you know, well, I just want to be coached on my work. Mm-hmm. And they separate out the rest of their being from their work, as if they're two compartmentalized parts of life. And I know that the little executive coaching that I've done, that actually at some point we talk about the rounded human being and all of their parts that exist, and not just this work part, because it's all interconnected. It all has a play upon itself.
I love that you brought this in, because for me, that's why I say that I see people, because I go into organizations and anybody who gets me to coach them, they see me come in, actually. They know they're not just going to have a conversation that is about work. You know, intuitively and instinctively, I go in and I have those missing conversations. I do that because I feel that that's the thing that has been congruent about me. You know, in terms of my whole coaching journey, my leadership journey, I feel that I have learned tremendously and continue to learn, Robert, from my mistakes and my failures. My life has not been straightforward. It has not been easy. There have been lots of wonderful things in my life, and there have been lots of challenges, as I imagine there are in many people's lives. But I think that sometimes I get frustrated at this perfection kind of image that some coaches give off, that their lives are, you know, perfectly polished, all in order, all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted, and they don't have any mess anywhere.
And there's something really interesting about that, because when we enter that coaching space, we are one human being working with another human being. And if we give off this air that we are perfect or above, how can we meet them? How can they be vulnerable in the space with us if they're looking up at us? And I've always found that really bizarre, that people want to have a hierarchy in the coaching space, as opposed to a let me meet you, warts and all, and kind of just share in that space and share my own vulnerability. Because without sharing my own as a coach, how can I invite that of my clients into the space?
It's called modeling, isn't it? It's called authenticity. It's called congruency. You know, for me, some of the greatest coaching that I have been engaged in has been when we've allowed ourselves in a bit like, do you know Otto Sharma's You going down? Well, even if you don't know, it's like, imagine that you're downloading. So you come in, you meet a client or a coachee, and, you know, they just download everything that's going on. You know, and then when you get, you download and then you get to the bottom, and that's where the real stuff is. You know, they say sometimes that the presenting issue is not the real issue.
But it very really is. It's just an indicator that something is there, something needs to be explored. And it's funny when coaches try to work on the presenting issue. They kind of get this idea that that's the thing, let's go for that, and don't allow time and space for the client to share what's going on, to really see what's sitting underneath, to go to those depths, to allow the real topics to land. And I guess that's also about, sometimes coaches want to show how good they are, so they want to get somewhere. You know, in the executive space where you're being paid to create results, as a coach, we're running to create those results, and don't always slow down to go, right, so what are we really creating results around, as opposed to that first thing that comes into the space?
I think that's so important because we're often rushing to get to the end of, you know, by the time you get to the end of Grow or T-Grow or you get to the end of Oscar, you've got a result, you've got an outcome, but you haven't got a connection. You haven't got a kind of inner knowing that, you know, it's something so beautiful and sometimes very sacred when a coachee hears their own voice. They hear their own wisdom. They come to their own inner knowing. They source the answer, the solution themselves by you holding that space for them to actually do that. And that doesn't mean that you don't use tools. You know, I'm very creative. You know, when it comes to my toolkit, it's kind of got no, it's got no bottom to it. I'm always pulling out stuff and should we use these cards? Should we use some imagery? But, you know, I do that in a way that's very intuitive. You know, I tend to vibe with what, you know, how, what I know about an individual or a coachee or a client. And, you know, I'm always about, this is an offering. You don't have to try this if you don't want to. But normally people grab things. They're like, yeah, let's, you know that this feels right for this moment. And then we all might immerse ourselves in that.
And I'm just curious about the point where that intuitivity or that intuitiveness, when did you arrive at a point to listen to that and to offer what was coming from that space?
What a lovely question, Robert. Yeah, what a lovely question. I would say I'm still arriving. Yeah, I feel like I started my professional career as a youth worker in the London Borough of Hackney. I'd finished my degree in government politics. My mum basically pushed me out of the house and said, go down that road to the youth club and go and get a job down there. You'd be good at that. You know, she probably didn't say it as nicely as that, but it was like, go do something.
Yeah.
And I ended up at this youth club in West Norwood where we lived as a family. And the senior youth worker was a Jamaican man. His name was Glenn Scott Thomas. Absolutely amazing man. And he gave me the job as a part-time youth worker there. And I tell you what, I found my feet. You know, I grew up with three brothers. Do you know what I mean? So there was a lot of young men in the youth club at that time. And I had a little bit of height, a little bit of a voice. Do you know what I mean? So I could kind of make out like I, you know, knew what I was talking about. But what I realized I was really, really interested in was developing people. I was hungry for development myself because of my own childhood, my own experiences growing up. And I probably really was motivated by that. And what was lovely about youth work was that it had a curriculum, it had learning and development, it had CPD. You know, the youth service was way ahead of its time back then in, giving my age away here, in the 1980s. So what happened was I got trained as a youth worker. Oh my God. They sent me on a training program that was talking about stuff I was interested in. You know, I did a degree in government and politics. Talk about ending up in the wrong place for 3 years. You know, to realize what you didn't want to do or what you didn't want to be. And then to come into youth work and find yourself having a voice, thinking, feeling, making sense of your own lived experiences. And my experience as a woman of color in the UK, being validated, being recognized, having a space where it was, you know, your lived experience was held and where you held that for other black youth workers. Oh, I mean, I was in my element.
It almost feels that we've gone back from that place because I remember back in the day, there was funding for that to happen. And over time, that has been stripped away. So that validation of self, that idea that our lived experiences of worth and how we share that, has kind of drifted, because I know in my own career working with young people, those youth spaces, those supported spaces have kind of disappeared.
Yes. But I think you also had, I think you're absolutely right. So our young people have been left by most parts. There's very, very little youth provision in a lot of boroughs now, which, you know, one can understand why there is a rise in young people's crimes and lots of other issues associated with growing up young in the UK, growing up particularly black in the UK, and, you know, just all of the challenges. I don't know how I would cope being a young woman of today. Do you know what I mean? That it's a different culture, different challenges that young people are faced with. So I think that's a huge problem now. And I guess where we are with the Black Lives Matter having a global, a platform. I say that with a lot of hesitation because, of course, there are many of us, this has been our lived experience. I keep using that word today, but it feels very appropriate. You know, 30 years ago, that was my experience.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed.
I guess that was one of the things that was really interesting about your career is that, so recognizing now that you started as youth work, I also know that you worked, I think it was with the BBC, creating opportunities for young people of color to work at the BBC. And I remember when I was thinking about talking with you, that the idea of, you know, what has changed, what has shifted over time and what hasn't. And I know that's a huge question to kind of explore.
I like that you've done your research really well. Hardly anybody asks me about my time at the BBC, but yet it was a pivotal moment in my career. And I have some very valuable experiences that have come out of that, actually. So I worked at the BBC, I think it was for about 2.5-3 years, running a mentoring scheme for young black people who were between the ages of 17 to 19, who were at college next door to the BBC at White City, at Hammersmith and West London College. That was what it was called back then. They recognised back then that there was an inequality in terms of the representation of black people in the media, and they wanted to do something about it. So News and Current Affairs and News and two departments funded the BBC mentoring program. And what they did was they mentored young students from the college with professional black media personnel, professionals in the BBC. Well, they got mentored with news presenters, camera people, producers of programs, producers of documentaries. I mean, they had the pick. And obviously, for a lot of those black media professionals, they were going through their own stuff in the BBC. But this was about them giving back. But not only that, we got, they got placements, they got into, you know, like when very often in the summer holidays, often it's who you know.
Yeah.
Call it the old boys network, the old girls networks. They got access into those networks, into the corridors and into the powers that they would never have gotten access to. Now, I interviewed every single one of those young people that came on the project. I would have taken them all. After we delivered the first project, we trained up about four of them to then co-facilitate with me on the next project so that we could have aspiring role models for them to look up to, not just for us leading the project, but for other role models around their ages, which was fantastic. Now, at least four of those young people are in their 40s now. One has won 2 or 3 BAFTAs, Quadro Dejan. The other heads up is a assistant head in a secondary drama school, who you, I think, know.
Yep, come here.
She was one of the pivotal people, you know, in terms of giving me inspiration, motivation. I saw potential just oozing out of her and all of these young people. It was just a joy to be able to create a space for them. So we've got Quadro, we've got Camille, we've got Tooks, who heads up a major young people's charity at the moment. I think he's just gone across to Tukumbu Olawolo. I'm not pronouncing his name right. He'll kill me for this. He's just gone across to a new post as a CEO. We've got Khadija Moncrief. I mean, we could just go on. Now, had they not been given that opportunity, would we have seen that potential in the same way? It was already there, but that opportunity gave them an opportunity to step up.
And this sort of makes me think about how coaching provides a platform for potential to be recognized, to be seen, to be given a voice, a space in order to grow.
Yeah.
But also how, I guess back then, were you called a coach then?
Really, that's a really good question. I tell you what, I'm going to place this in a context. So when I started working as a part-time youth worker, I got my part-time youth work qualification. And then Glenn mentored me in a very sort of like, oh, you know, there's this full-time workers post coming up in Hackney. I think you should go for it. And I'm like, me? Go for the full-time youth? Yeah, I think you'd be okay. I think you should go for it. And I did. Went for the interview, blew them away, got the job. Absolutely one of my best jobs ever. Now, when I was in that role, because of the CPD that Ilya was totally invested in, I would say back then there was anti-racist work going on in our organizations, in our, you know, in the youth sector in particular. And one of the CPD interventions was everyone was given, all full-time workers were given what they called a non-managerial supervisor. This was somebody outside of your work who was a senior leader who was basically a coach. So I had these one-to-one sessions with my coach once a month for about 2 hours. I'll never forget the first session that I had with my coach. Her name was Rose. She was a black senior leader in another youth organization in somewhere like Haringey. When I sat down in the room and we started talking, I thought she was going to be getting out her notebook and giving me all of these ideas of how I should be, how I should talk, how I should speak up in meetings. She started asking me questions about what did I want to do with my life. I was blown away. I was like, hold on a minute. I didn't know this was going to be part of the experience. Very, very quickly, she got me to articulate my vision. And my vision was, because I did a degree in government politics, I wasn't qualified as a full-time youth worker. I was what you call an unqualified youth worker. Interestingly enough, in the youth organization that I worked in, where I think there were 6 full-time youth workers, the 2 black youth workers, 2 out of 3 of the black youth workers, full-time youth workers, were unqualified. So that actually gave us an unequal distribution of power, because we were actually paid like quite a significant amount less than our colleagues who were qualified. And she coached me. She said, you're going to go and get that qualification. And I did. And I ended up leaving the organization, going into the criminal justice system. I got fed up in the criminal justice system, going into court with white young men and then black young men. They would have similar custodial interventions, and yet one would come home with me and one set wouldn't. You know, after this happened several times, you begin to realize that you know, talk about unconscious bias on the magistrate's bench. And I became very, very frustrated because I'd had interactions with the police from my brothers growing up, you know, young men on the street. I was very vocal when it came to police presence in areas. And I just, my values just didn't sit right with this. So I knew that I wanted to come out of that environment because I didn't really feel like I was making a difference. Maybe now I would need to be a magistrate so that I could, you know, I could really offer something back to community. But back then I knew that I wasn't making the impact that I wanted to make. So I ended up in, I segued into learning and development. I went into working with young people leaving care. And I could really see how I was running young women's groups. I was working as a key worker with young people in care. We were doing a lot of social education with them. I could see, I could actually tangibly see how I was offering something. And that really, you know, that's where I kind of settled. And then I became a mother and I wanted to work closer to home. And I was appointed as a women's training officer in the London Borough of Southwark. And that's where it all, it's like, you know, you plant a tree and the roots grow down, the trunk grows, the branches go. I then became this person whose branches started waving in the wind as I realized all of the kind of things that I could do and make happen. So I went in there with literally no budget and had like a budget for 750,000, but I managed. And I sent, you know, I put on brilliant training programs. I got accredited programs for women to go through. I brought in a diverse range of trainers and facilitators. Some of those people are still in my life today. And I just really made a difference. But it was hard because I was in middle management. The chief executive wanted me to accelerate into a senior role. I was struggling with my own imposter syndrome. Do you know what I mean? And I hadn't really worked out the kind of right support in terms of taking a coach with me or a mentor with me. So I was kind of scrabbling around trying to make sense of all of this. But I was very, very vocal around a table of all white faces. There was me, you know, speaking out, probably saying things that, you know, I probably wouldn't be able to get away with now, but because you don't know, you just do it. So I, you know, I learned on the job, you know, I learned, you know, what it means to be strategic. I learned that, you know, you don't always have to kick down a door to enter a room. That I could actually begin to make alliances, that I could network, and I could still hold on to who I am, that I didn't have to assimilate, you know, that actually, you know, who I am, my identity, my culture, my diversity of thought is wealth, you know, in any situation. I think if people have me in their space, it's valuable for me to be in there. Do you know what I mean? And I want that connection to happen, you know, with whoever I'm engaging with.
And that comes right back to that kind of first comment in our conversation is, you know, is working with human beings and not being the label, being the person that actually sees who sat there and sees them for who they are and kind of reflecting that potential within them. And it feels like you've gone on this kind of growth journey, pushing the edges and the barriers so that you could then enable others to go on that journey as well.
I think you could say so. I think sometimes when people ask me how I am and I say, oh, this is happening in my life, they look at me like, are you for real? Like, you know, is that really part of your lived experience? But we can't always determine what life throws in our direction. You know, I was thinking about coming onto this call today. And one of the words that came to me is like right where I am right now in my life, it's like it feels like I'm in a transition. And a transition is different to a change. A transition is about a psychological inner processes. You know, the psychological changes that we go through when things move on or things change and things are different. I feel like I COVID-19, I feel like that's been my sweet spot for my work. I feel like I have been ready for this moment all my life.
That's really interesting. So what is it about this moment in time and your work that have found that synergy?
We're having the conversations. It's not about missing conversations. People are taking off the masks. We're showing up vulnerable. We're being real. I thrive in that space. You know, when I have to, I mean, it's really important to be agile. What, you know, whoever you are as a coach, we need to be agile. Now, what's interesting for me is that, you know, I grew up in South London. You know, my brother, one of my brothers is a DJ. I can be out raving with my brother and there's a whole host of us having great conversations, laughing, many of us professionals, but we are able to flex in one situation and then go into a boardroom and be at that table, you know, presenting something, co-facilitating, facilitating, running a program, coaching a CEO, coaching a senior leader. We are able to flex because of the quality of the skills, the quality of the experience, that our willingness to look beyond. This is one of the things that gets me frustrated about the coaching community. I hope this doesn't sound like a whinge. But, you know, I don't think that many people are willing to look beyond what they know. And when I say that, let me give you an example. I was at a funeral. I've been at two funerals this week. COVID has been about a lot of death and a lot of grief. It was for a beloved friend's mother, and the family all gave them amazing tributes. And one of the things that really stood out, well, it stood out right from the beginning, was they loved their mother in a way because they each detailed how she was able to demonstrate all the way through their life how much she loved them. You know, that whole thing we're talking about, being able to witness people, to really see people. And her one of her grandchildren got up and said a poem. And the poem was the William Wordsworth poem, "I Wandered Lonely Like a Cloud."
Yep.
Now, when I read the program, the children shared in the eulogy that their mother's favorite program that she, poem that she used to recite was "I Wandered Lonely Like a Cloud." The week before, I'd written an article for a national magazine, and I talked about the first poem I ever learned was "I Wandered Lonely Like a Cloud." Right? So here we go. William Wordsworth, the poem. I learned it at school. Her granddaughter learns it from her. She learns it in Jamaica. Yeah, that's, you know, that's how far, when we talk about white privilege, when we talk about a Eurocentric approach, we were conditioned to learn only particular types of literature, language, etc. But yet, we have come out of that. My house is full of books. You know, I moved about 3 years ago. I gave away about 200 books. Why do I have a diverse collection of books? Why am I able to go out and look beyond what I was taught, what I was conditioned? Why wouldn't you want to be curious?
So am I hearing in that when you talked about the coaching profession and your frustration with that coaching professionals are not going beyond what they've learned, they're not pushing those boundaries, they're not finding new and different?
I'm not going to say all, but I think we could push a lot more. I really, really do. I think that coaching is it's doing some great work, don't get me wrong, but I, as agents of change, I think there's something that needs to change about the branding of coaching. It's very middle class. I, you know, it's hard for me to say it, but it's a very middle class profession. It's a very white profession. I've been talking to a friend recently who wants to train as a coach. And it's very expensive.
Mm.
It's not.
So what do we, and not necessarily saying that you will have the answer to this, but it's a question that I've been asking myself, that we've been talking about, that Animus is. So what is it that one does about this? How do we create opportunity and create diversity within that coaching profession?
We have to get innovative. We have to think about, you know, why are we not funding places? Why are we not offering scholarships? Why are we not offering a course in a community where you can draw those leaders in those communities and give a program that is an accredited program back to that community? So they're getting the same quality of training, but you know you're putting back, you're giving back into a community. Instead, you know, we tend to end up, I don't know, maybe you can talk a bit about what you're seeing at Animus. You're there. So, you know, maybe you have a much more diverse range of people who are coming to, you know, book onto your programs. But I think we have to be talking to a lot more of the black coaches in the sector, because I made a little note to myself. I was thinking, who are these black coaches? I know I've recommended quite a few of them to you. To talk to, and actually every day a new name kind of pops into my head. Oh my god, yeah, I've got to give this name to Robert. But what I noticed when I started to write the names down, people like Eden Charles, Dr. Eden Charles, Dr. Ian Phillips, Carol Campaign, Paul Campaign, Jenny Garrett. There are just so many. They often are either running their own consultancies or they're quietly beavering away somewhere in another organization.
This is really interesting because when I did a roundtable discussion around diversity with Bob and Simon and Salma, one of the questions that I was posing is where do the coaches go? Because I know we train them at Animus because I see them in the room, but then I don't see them outside of the room. I mean, I see them socially, of course, but I mean, in terms of what are they doing? And it's almost like they go away and they have a plan, they have a thing they want to do, and they go and they get on with it. And one of the things that I want to do later on this year or early next year is to have a platform where we kind of share what coaches of diversity, because it won't just be about culture and color, it'll be about the full range of diversity and inclusion. What are we doing? Where are we? How are we working to kind of shine a light on that?
I think that's very important, because I was thinking about the professional coaching body that I am a member of, that I pay up membership to. I've never seen a person of colour present on any of their CPD. What does that tell me as a BAME coach? What message, what signal is that sending out to, you know, in terms of diversity, in terms of inclusion, in terms of welcoming BAME coaches into the association? Yeah, I pay into that organization. And, you know, I asked myself the question, well, why haven't you spoken out about this? And I realized that the way I've spoken out about it is I don't go to their CPD events anymore. I haven't been for years. Yet, ethically, it is important to sign up to a professional body.
And it's interesting that we may not go to their events, because one of the things that I witness when I go to events is that there aren't others at the event.
Yeah.
And it might be because they don't see themselves represented at those events, so they choose not to go.
Yes.
And then I go, so how do we call out those organizations and go, but we want to be represented so that we can come to these events, so that we can be part of this? And how do we create change in that way, as opposed to stepping, and I'm not saying you're stepping back, because I don't think that's anything you would do, but instead of stepping away, how do we lean into it and go, okay, let's have a conversation, let's create some change, let's shake this up a bit to create difference.
You're making me think about, you know, the pie chart where you look at image exposure and working hard. And I think this is exactly what we're talking about here, is the exposure that we often might, we might talk about it, but then we take ourselves away from it. Because I've been telling myself for years, I don't want to lead, I want to impact and I want to influence. But I don't particularly want to be in a leadership role. And I convinced myself that that would mean that I would have to step up into a leadership role. But I think there are many different ways that we can make an impact. I mean, I'm very good at writing letters. I'm very good at, you know, voicing my opinions. You know, people tell me that, you know, I bring my voice into meetings and conversations very well. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's not just about how do we call out these organizations. And for me, it's not about calling them out to pull them down, but it is to say, you know what, I am part of your membership and you are not reflecting society. You're not reflecting, you know, the very people that you are meant to be serving. And to be fair, Robert, there's lots of brilliant young coaches coming through the ranks. They're sharp. They're on the ball. They're going nowhere near these professional organizations because they know nothing about them, because mm-hmm. they don't reach them. They don't know they're there. They don't know where they are.
It sort of gets the wheels turning and me wondering about, so what does one do about that? Because I can sit here and we can have this great conversation and people can listen to this and go, oh, I'll find out about them. But what, how do we do more? Because one of the conversations that Nick and I had, so Nick Bolton, the founder and CEO of Animus, we had this conversation about, so how can we do more? Because we've spoken about it. He and I have been at conferences and looked at each other and looked around and gone, something's up here. And now's a time when we're going, okay, what do we do about this? How do we make an impact? How do we create influence? So I'm just kind of going, I don't know what that looks like as an outcome of this conversation, but it feels like there is something there to kind of build on.
Can you see my face? Could you? I think I'm bursting. It was bubbling up a little bit when I was kind of preparing to speak with you today. And I'm wondering whether it is time for a Black Association of Coaches or a national chapter in one of the key accrediting coaching bodies. And I'm thinking that perhaps that's an area that you'll explore more when you speak with Jenny, and the fact that she started up the BAME Coaches Directory. But it's something that came to me when I was out walking this week. Is it time that we began to lead on, it's not lead on the agenda, but actually begin to articulate what are the conversations that we really now need to be having in the coaching community? Because this work needs to be done, some of this work needs to be done separately. You know, it's really, really important. And I was thinking back to the earlier part of our conversation when we were talking about the youth service, because I had the experience of working with white co-facilitators who were anti-racist, and to experience what it was like to have somebody who was checking themselves, was doing that inner work, was politically aware and astute, could empathize with diverse ranges of experiences, which, you know, to be fair to a huge part of the coaching community, they're not extending themselves to do that. Some are.
And I think part of that, and I think part of that extension is that it isn't being called for, or they're not seeing the necessity of, because nobody's kind of addressing that within their learning. And it's one of the things that at Animus, I've been talking with a lady called Myra Khan, who teaches on intersectionality.
Yes.
And we've been exploring creating a course for coaches.
Yes.
Looks at, so how do we look at that? How do we sit with that? And had some really interesting conversations around how do we create groups but educate those that are not in that group to recognize that sometimes we need that shared experience space to discuss things that we that only exists within that shared experience. And then we can come into other groups and other spaces to share that and to work together. So it's not about excluding. Mm-hmm. It's about bringing together so a sharing can take place that can then come into the larger space.
This is collective work we need to do in the coaching community. You know, the way that we do it is, you know, that is up for conversation. But this is collective work that needs to be done. Otherwise, we will continue to have those missing conversations whilst the rest of the world is happening out there with, you know, the, you know, Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, all of the African Americans, male and female, whose lives have been taken in such a cruel and unempathetic way by the, you know, the American police. We've had similar things here in the UK, but we go on as if this is not happening on our doorstep, and you know that's actually not true. And I have some very, very good and close friends in the coaching community who are white, and we do have these conversations. And let me tell you, it makes a difference. It makes a difference to me. It makes a difference to them. It makes a difference to the work that I then go out and do. It makes a difference to the work that they then go out and do. You cannot, there will only be value that comes back from doing this work in a wholehearted way. And you know what, one of the things I would say is that there is so much out there, you know, and I try to kind of manage myself. I'm often overwhelmed with admin and email and all of that in terms of just trying to, you know, manage your business. But that's because there is just such a wealth of knowledge out there. I listen to podcasts. Do you know what? A lot of the cutting edge information is not down in books. It's down in the conversations people are having online. So we have to come out of the learning models that we are, the learning modality, sorry, that we are used to, and really extend the range of our learning portfolio. Because, you know, I think that a lot of people are going to get a lot more. If you're a white coach or non-BAME coach, you know, listen to Robin DiAngelo talking about white fragility. You know, go into her book, go into her work. You know, black coaches, we need to be thinking about what are the healing and the restorative places that we can come together. Because so often the work that we're doing with BAME coaches is about healing and restorative practices because of the microaggressions, the racism, the oppression that they face on a daily basis that is included in all of the other challenges that they're up against in their day-to-day work. Now, if you go in and you coach somebody and you have no idea that this is part, I'm not going to say part of their lived experience, that this is part of their experience, then you're not getting to what you talked about earlier, which is the whole. So if you haven't even got a curiosity about that, you don't empathize with that. It doesn't matter if you live in Newcastle. You know, London is not a grey space. It's a green space. There are BAME people here who are affluent, who have done well, whose children are doing well, who are thriving. There are healthy communities all over the place, and there are challenges. Do you know what I mean? You've got to be able to sit with both and know that there's potentiality in all of it.
It feels very much like there's a piece of work for you and I to begin here, or perhaps this is the beginnings of a piece of work. These are the seeds of something to grow in our fertile ground, as it were.
I think so. I think that we cannot let this time go by without us making a change. And that change has to be from root up in the coaching community. And I really want to thank you actually for what you've just said, because, you know, trauma and resilience exists in our history and our culture. There is a huge richness in our history and our culture beyond imagination. We have to reclaim those spaces. And the thing about this work is that we cannot do it alone. That's been my Achilles heel. I tend to go off and think that, oh, yeah, I see this, I see that. No, I'm going to speak out about this. And then, you know, this is where you can get to burnout, exhaustion, or you get so overwhelmed. You think, that's why sometimes we bury our heads and we go under. Because actually there is a real strength when we collaborate.
So Jackie, you know, I'd like to invite you to begin that collaboration, as this, you know, this conversation feels like very much the beginning of it. Perhaps it's not to begin the collaboration, it's to continue that collaboration, to come together to see, you know, what is it that we can do with the work that we do, with the organizations that we work with, to be part of that voice, to be part of that bringing that collective together, to have those missing conversations or those unheard conversations, to bring those into a wider space and kind of see where that takes us. Mm-hmm.
I think that sounds like a very inviting invitation, Robert. You know, I think sometimes we don't appreciate what seeds have been planted, but I know that the seeds are there. It really is about us giving them water. Okay. You know, it's because, and I think that, you know, the more of us can come together and water, the more we will create breathing space for what will grow out of this. And I think that this, you know, this time is ripe, and, you know, we don't want it to over-ripen, because, you know, the time is now. It's not a coincidence that we are having this conversation now.
Yeah. It reminds me of one of the things that Nick sometimes talks about, is that there are moments in time where something happens and it only exists in that moment. Yeah. So if you hesitate for too long, it's gone. So I guess I'm saying, let's not hesitate. Let's create something or allow something to emerge from this space. Yeah. And just to say, you know, thank you so much for being on this podcast and for sharing this conversation with me. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you as well. I've really appreciated the depth of your questions and the way that you have brought yourself into the conversation. And sometimes you don't know necessarily where the conversation will take you. But I feel like I'm leaving enriched and energized because of my connection with you, Robert, and the way in which you have so masterfully facilitated and held this conversation. And I really do hope that people will, you know, come to this conversation and something will touch them, move them, engage them. Please feel free to you know, to find me on Instagram at Jackie Hole, JACKEEHOL, because the reason I mention Instagram, because that's where I show up, warts and all, you know, just doing my thing as I go about my day. All my, you know, my coaches can find me there, but that's where I express my creativity. And it's great. We have some great conversations on Instagram. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and I'll speak with you soon.
Thank you.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.